Hello and welcome. I'm Joe Collins and this is Cover to Cover. We've got an action-packed show for you today. It's quite full. Michael Smart is in the studio with me. He's going to review To Wake at a Decent Hour by Joshua Ferris. It was one of the nominations in the Man Booker for the Man Booker Prize. Is that right, Michael?
Yeah.
And so he's been reading it. Also, I'll have Peter Sir, as promised. He'll be coming into the studio later on to talk about his book, his debut novel, Black Wreath. And he'll also be reading something from a book of a collection of poetry that he's put together. I've been looking at it myself. It's very interesting. Hello, Michael.
Hi.
How are you?
Hi, Joe.
How you doing?
Fine.
What about that book?
It's the book is To Rise Again at a Decent Hour by Joshua Ferris. It's American. As you said, it was one of the shortlisted books for the Man Booker Prize, which we recently decided on. It didn't win, but it was shortlisted. It was written in the last year. Joshua Ferris is relatively young writer. He was born in 1974. He sort of came to fame really in the late 70s. His first book appeared in 2007, the first novel, Then We Came to the End, it was called. And it achieved a certain amount of, I don't know, notoriety is hardly the word, but he got a very substantial advance to it. So it was very well publicized.
I believe it was described as a slick, neat and knowing.
I haven't read it, but it got a lot of attention, and then his second book obviously did as well. But so this is the third one. He was in 2010. He made the New Yorker's 20 under the list of under 20 under 40 list of fiction writers. You know,
top 20 under 40 writers.
20 under 40, yeah. The New Yorkers do a list every so often of writers under 40, and they list what they consider the top 20, and he made that in 2010 his second book. So
I'd imagine that'd be a fair accolade.
I
suspect that New York critics would be backward and coming forward, as they would throw stones at a target imagine.
And he had, I think, some stones thrown at him about his first novel. As I said, it achieved a certain, because he was well publicized. He was born in 1974 in Illinois, but he lives now in New York. He's based in New York.
So he's just turned that magic 40.
He's just
hasn't
about turned 40. Yeah.
Is that reflected in his book? You see,
No, I don't think so. No, it's just I'm just giving a bit of background that he's young. It's his third book. He's I suppose just about an established author, but he's relatively young. It's been hailed as a very funny book, and
I believe so. Yeah,
it is in some respects. Now it depends on your sense of humor. I would have to say it's not a sort of laugh out loud book.
Right, would you satirical
satirical
in an intellectual sort of a way?
One of the reviewers that here said that the main character, Paul O'Rourke, who's a dentist, is almost a sort of anti-hero. He's bordering on, or some people would see him as a crank, you know.
Is this comedy for the middle classes, Michael? it's actually said, I mean, it's a Park Avenue practice, so I mean, we're talking big bucks here. It's not what we'd describe as middle class.
What happened is he's made it. Paul O'Rourke, the main character, who's in his late 30s, it's set in the present day, and he's a dentist, and he started out with a small room in a suburb somewhere, but he's, at the time he's writing now, he's made it in dentistry term. He has a practice on Park Avenue in the fashionable part of New York.
Anybody knows New York, that's the big swathe that sort of cuts down.
And in
down
fact
from
he
Central
writes
Park
he writes about that in the book. He describes Park Avenue as being, not very typical of a lot of the rest of New York and so on. But he has a big practice where he has five rooms. Of course, most dentists, certainly any dentists that I go to in this country, they have one consulting room, and they have a a dental nurse and a secretary, but in big practices...
I've actually experienced that, yeah, where they have maybe three rooms on the go and they're running from a customer.
Yeah, well, he has five rooms, he says. And he's now, whether that includes the way one of the rooms is occupied, he has four people who work, or three people who work with him. He has a nurse who sort of assists him and stands beside him. And he has a secretary, office manager type who manages the appointments and so on, and he has a hygienist, of course, in big practices like this. Whereas if you go to the dentist, not only does he take out teeth and do cavities, but he also cleans and polishes and things. But in big practices, they have somebody who's not a qualified dentist,
right,
but who's specialist as a hygienist.
Yes, yes.
So she Mrs. Convoy, it is in this book, she's one of the characters, but it's very much dominated by him. And he's, so in material terms, you'd say, well, he's made it, but he's not happy.
Right.
And where I suppose a lot of the comedy comes in, because you learn about his identity. He sort of,
is that the nucleus of the
yeah,
the
that's
of,
the
yeah,
nucleus
yeah, yeah.
of it. He's searching for identity, I suppose, is the phrase when you use. You know, he's not happy. You learn during the book that probably the motivating event in his life was you find his father committed suicide, which he doesn't really talk much about, but obviously had an effect on him. And he is an atheist. But
is he a closet atheist, do you think?
No, he's not a closet atheist, but he's a man who sort of feels he'd like to believe in God, but he can't relate a sort of benign God with the misery that he sees all around him, and particularly that he comes into contact with his patients. So, I mean,
sorry, I think I misrepresented myself there. I was asking, was he closeted atheist?
No.
What I really think I was trying to put into words was, you know, there's no atheist in a foxhole. I was wondering, was he that sort? He was outwardly an atheist, but
no.
when it come to biting the bullet, you know, we're all down on our knees going, please, God.
Yeah. Well, there's an element
our
of
last
that. There's
sermon,
an element of that.
You know,
of it. I'll read a paragraph from it, which sort of describes the story. I would have liked to believe in God. Now, there was something that could have been everything better than anything else. By believing in God, I could succumb to ease and comfort and reassurance. Fearlessness was an option. Eternity was mine. It could all be mine. The awesome pitch of organ pipes, the musings of Anglican bishops. All I had to do was put away my doubts and believe. Whenever I was on the verge of that, I would call myself back from the brink. Keep clarity, I would cry. Hold on to yourself. For the reason the world was so pleasurable, and why I wanted to extend that pleasure through total submission to God, was my thoughts, my reasoned, stubborn, sceptical thoughts, which always, unfortunately, make quick work of God. In other words, he keeps sort of seeing this misery in the world around him, and particularly the patients that he comes to see, because he obviously, you know, comes face to face, or as one reviewer said, mouth to face with patients.
Yeah.
And so he can't relate that to God. So he's searching for an identity, and he gets involved in all sorts of things. He takes up golf. You know, this is before the book starts. You find that he's immersed himself totally in golf for 3 months, and then
is
got
he
fed
obsessive
up with
that. In that sort of
yeah,
a way?
Yeah, he's obsessive,
you know,
in that sense.
Yeah.
And he's totally obsessed with Boston Red Sox. He's a baseball fan of the Boston
baseball.
Red Sox.
I was going to say football.
No, baseball, the Boston Red Sox. And of course, the Boston Red Sox, as you mean, are a rather unusual baseball team. Well, not it's unusual, but the record is somewhat unusual, that they were formed in the early part of the 20th century, around 1901 or so. And they were a very successful team for the first 15 or 20 years of their existence. And the major series in the States, what's called the World Series, although the world comes from the newspaper, the title of the newspaper that sponsors it. It's
a
lot of people confused. Wonder how could
it's
be
all
a
American,
how could
course,
there be a World
yes.
Series? Well, it's actually the sponsor. It's actually the world is the sponsoring newspaper. That's
although to a lot
series.
Of people, you know, a lot of people living in America, the world does end east and west coasts.
Indeed, but. The Red Sox won this series in 1918, and didn't win it again for another 86 years, even though they didn't win it again in 2004, even though they had, over that time, they had some excellent players and allegedly excellent teams, but they never win it. And the story was that they were cursed, that in 1980, Babe Ruth, of course, who was the major baseball hero of the 20s and 30s.
I have heard that name.
Joined the New York Yankees. But he actually originally played for the Boston Red Sox, and they sold him to the New York Yankees. Right. And of course, he went on to be the great, at that time, the greatest baseball player ever. And the story goes that as a result of that, the Boston Red Sox were cursed that they would never win the championship again. And when they eventually won it in 2004, after 86 years, it was the longest gap that they'd ever been between teams winning it. Now, in fact, they've won it a few times since. In fact, I think they've won it. They're the first team to win it three times in the 21st century. He's an absolutely obsessive about Boston Red Sox, you know, with his cap, and he has to watch all the games, or he doesn't seem to go to them, but he watches them on television, or he records them faithfully, and he has to, even on one stage of the book, he has to persuade a patient to let him watch the match in his apartment and so on. He has had various relationships with various women over the years, including one which at the time the book starts has just ended, which is with the woman who is his secretary office manager, who is from a Jewish family. Uh-huh. And he describes not his relationship with her, but when he has a relationship with a woman, he wants to totally immerse himself in her family. So he talks about this woman who he was going out with for a time, who was a Catholic, and he tried to sort of get into the heads of Catholicism. And now Connie, his receptionist, who he's just broken up with at the start of the book.
Did you say he was originally Jewish?
No, he's not Jewish. He's Anglican. Well, I don't know what religion he originally has. He didn't have any particular religion. But he's fascinated by religion, and he tries to immerse himself and get, you know, he offers all of Connie's relations, all her family, free dentistry. Of course, none of them turn up.
Okay.
So he's searching around for this. So it's and, you know, he rants about these things, and in that sense it's funny. And he hates modern technology and the way that people get hooked on smartphones and the internet, and people who are sort of sitting as his patients, their phone rings and they have to answer.
I believe he terms them me machines.
He calls his phone his me machine, and he refers to it as his me machine. And which becomes significant in the story. So that's his basic character.
Just listening to you read that passage that you did. It almost sounds like a poetic, poetically rhythmical.
Yeah.
And, you know, quite a lot of, I was noticing there's quite a lot of alliteration used there. It gives it a nice sort of a... rhythmic movement to it.
I'll read another. This is the opening paragraph of the book, which really sets the tone, because he's a dentist, so obviously he's talking about people's mouths. This is the opening paragraph. The mouth is a weird place. Not quite inside and not quite out. Not skin and not organ, but something in between. Dark, wet, admitting access to an interior most people would rather not contemplate. Where cancer starts, where the heart is broken, where the soul might just fail to turn up. It's an interesting description of the mouth. What happens during the book is that he has this, you know, he's set the scene in the opening paragraph, in the opening chapters. You find he has this very successful, or on the face of it, very successful dental practice. But he's searching for identity and, you know, isn't happy. And then there's an incident with a patient, which he doesn't pay any heed to, that he has this man in the chair who has a very bad tooth, and he has to take it out.
Yes.
And in conversation with him, the man tells him that he was at one stage a Tibetan monk, which has nothing to do with anything particularly. And then he gives him he refuses to have full gas anesthetic. He wants a local anesthetic. Yes. So he gives him a local anesthetic, and he starts to work on the tooth, and the man starts howling,
certainly feeling the pain.
Moaning. So he stops and says, "Are you in pain?" He says, "No, I can't feel it." No, it's fine. And he said, "But you're moaning." He said, oh, yes, well, no, it wasn't anything to do with that. And so he starts again, and the guy said, so eventually the guy sort of says, "Oh, look, give me the full treatment, give me gas." And so he knocks him out and he does the work, and that's all right. And then he puts him, you know, obviously he has to be in a normal way, he has to go into recovery to come out of the gas. And so he goes off to another patient, and he's talking, and then his secretary comes up to him and says, "Oh, your man is okay, and he just wants to say goodbye." So he goes to see him, and he senses that although he's up and walking around, he's not totally out of thing. And he's saying to him, "Are you sure you're ready to go now? You don't want to sit down?" No, I'm fine. And as he's going, he says, "I mentioned to you, I have to go because I'm going to Israel shortly."
Right.
Oh, yes, he says. "Well, I'm going to Israel because I'm an Ulm, ULM, and so are you."
Right.
"So are you." And of course, he doesn't know what an Ulm is, but he makes it, passes in no heat. But that's, you know, thinks no more about it. And then 6 months later, he discovers that somebody is guilty of what could be called identity theft, that somebody has set up a website in his name which purports to be the website of Paul O'Rourke, dentist in New York, which isn't. Wondered why is this going on. And first of all, the website is quite accurate. It just says who he is and so on and so forth. But then in the middle of it, he starts seeing quotes from the Bible and other similar sources, which he doesn't subscribe to at all. And some of them he finds to be quite anti-Semite. And then these start to appear on Twitter as well, as if they're coming from him. So he gets very upset about this, that somebody is stealing his identity and putting out all this stuff, pretending to be him when it's not him. And he is determined to find out who's doing it. So he starts making efforts.
Are they vicious, demeaning sort of representations of his purported views?
Yeah,
or
is it
comical?
It's not
sort
vicious,
of
vicious. It's comical. It's as I said, it's biblical. It's literally putting chunks of quotes from the Bible, some of which are difficult to understand, and some of which, as I said, have tones of anti-Semite things about them. You know, they're not all biblical. But
does it convey his cranky, grumpy character?
No, he doesn't understand what it is. It doesn't convey anything, you know. But he's determined to find out what this is. So he becomes fixated with trying to find out who's doing it and what it is. And he finds the sort of author of the website, and this leads him into a whole story of meeting people. He eventually hires lawyers and all sorts of things to find this. And it turns out that they tell him this reference that this guy made, "You're an Ulm." He finds that the Ulms are a sector tribe, part of one of the lost tribes of Israel, the Amalekites, who were allegedly wiped out by the Israelites at some stage, but maybe they weren't. And the suggestion is that he's actually a descendant of
these
tribes.
And
at one stage in his...
Does that appeal to him?
Not really.
Does it legitimize his religious obsession?
Not initially. He doesn't believe it and he doesn't understand it. But then gradually... partly through the investigations of the people he talks to, but also he gets to somebody who has traced his family tree all the way back, and his name is O'Rourke, which has sort of former Irish connections. But in fact, when they trace back, they give him his whole family tree, and they find that one of his ancestors was not O'Rourke, was Rourke, that the O obviously was acquired somewhere down the line in mistranslation or something, you know, that he was. And then if you go further back, the name wasn't Rourke at all. It was it was a name, I think it's Boruch, B-O-R-U-C-H. Right. And that apparently, as did happen quite a lot in immigration, you know, when immigration officers were writing down names, they just sort of...
That's right. Errors,
and that this name is not doesn't have any sort of European or origins, that it seems more likely that he in fact has some descendants, you know, that he probably originated somewhere in the Middle East or wherever. And so this idea that he actually is a descendant in some way, and this fascinates him.
Oh,
and
goodness.
But he doesn't know, and he comes across all these weird characters in his, which impinge on his history, or don't impinge on his history. And in some ways he goes off the wall totally, and in other ways he lives with this, and by the end of the book is sort of somewhat accommodating to it. I mean, that's it. There's nothing there's no sort of real beginning, middle and end in story terms,
right,
to it,
right.
And
as it develops, does it point towards some sort of a conclusion?
Not really. It doesn't, you know.
Not that we want you to give away the end.
Well, there isn't an end.
There,
I mean,
end.
You could argue that right. that he sort of finds himself through this, but maybe he does, maybe he does. You're still at the end not absolutely sure that he's found himself. He seems to have got rid of some of his obsessions, but maybe he's just become obsessed with different things. He at one stage, having broken up with Connie, his secretary, he decides he wants to get back together with her. But by this stage, she's moved on and she's got a new boyfriend who she now is going to marry. And she leaves and resigns. His dental nurse just ups and walks out one day. You know, he finds that.
So there's, people that
he thought he, you know, respected him, he liked, don't really. You know,
it's
that
like
they
sort of organized chaos.
Yeah,
to a degree.
Yeah.
Well, would you? You liked the book, did you, Michael?
It was interesting. It wouldn't be everybody's cup of tea. As I said, it's portrayed as a comedy, and it's funny in the way he rants about things. And that's, but it's not a laugh out loud thing. I mean, it's funny this sort of referring to his smartphone as a me machine and people's me machines, and you know that they're. And his quest to find some meaning in life through the religion, which means that he has to not only, if he has a girlfriend, he has to know her family and try to get further into it. And then he can't understand why there will be people in the family who are, you know, Catholics, but still sort of atheists, you know. And even at one stage he meets or comes across this woman who's Jew, who subscribes to all the Jewish beliefs, but yet doesn't believe in God. And he said, you know, how can you be a Jew and not believe in God? And why not, you know?
It sounds very interesting.
Yeah, so it's interesting. And, you know, there are various other side issues, like this man who comes in to him one day and you know, he feels fine, in perfect health, and when he goes into his mouth he realises the guy hasn't been to a dentist for a while and he has three cavities which need filling. So he said, I'd better fill these, and the guy says, no, don't bother. And he said, but your cavities, you know. He said, but they're not bothering me. He said, no, they may not be now, but in 6 months' time they will. He said, well, fine, I'll have them attended to then. He said, I feel fine, you know.
Yeah.
I don't have three cavities. He said, but you do have three cavities. He said, no, I feel fine. I don't feel as if I have. He said, when I feel as if I have, I'll get them fixed.
Oh, my God, okay.
And you can sort of understand that sort of thing, although it's not one's normal reaction to these things. So that's it anyway, that they, you know, To Rise Again at a Decent Hour. It's published by Penguin Viking, Joshua Ferris.
Published by Penguin.
Published by, well, it's Penguin, it's Viking, which are an imprint of Penguin. He started writing it apparently in 2004. And did it in bits and scraps since.
Oh, right, so it's quite it's a long project.
It's a long project. And he obviously wrote two other books in the meantime. So Anyway.
Lovely, bubbly.
That's it.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. That's Michael with To Wake at a Decent Hour, which it does sound very interesting.
To Rise Again at a Decent Hour.
Oh, sorry, To Rise Again at a Decent
Hour. And I'm not sure that it does come up in the text at one stage. I don't quite know why.
Paraphrasing it.
I don't quite know where the title comes from, and although it does mention in the text at some stage.
Okay, we'll be back in a moment. Thank you, Michael. Thank you very much.
Joe.
And welcome back to Cover to Cover. As promised, I have Peter Sir in the studio with me. I'll be talking to him in just a moment. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
I did promise outside broadcast recording of the Dublin Book Festival, but due to a technical issue with the recording, I'm afraid it's unable to be used. It was a vibrant experience. There was a crash upstairs in the banqueting hall for the children. There was a coffee shop with some lovely eats on the go. But most of all, there was an atmosphere of encouragement and positive association with books and reading. And there really was a buzzing dynamic about it. I never seen so many happy people gathered in the one place, and that's been truthful, from the lines of adoring fans who were getting their books signed by Francis Brennan and Derek Bannon. But there was a real a positive sort of festive spirit about the whole occasion. Some great books on offer, very accommodating for the public, and in a lovely building. Anyone who hasn't visited Smock Alley, it's in the form of an old church where the render has been taken off the walls, the brick exposed. Lovely place, could recommend it, and the Dublin Book Festival certainly looked to be a success. Anyway, there we go. Thanks for everybody that did contribute. Sorry, I haven't got that. And also to Michael Sharp, who I did introduce as Michael Smart. Sorry, Michael. So, without further delay, Peter Sir is here to talk about his book, Black Wreath. And his new compilation of poems, which is called The Rooms. And I was reading to myself, and some very appealing poetry there for those who may be interested. And even for someone who may not be particularly interested in poetry, it's I found it very expressive, a lot of it very contemporary, and interesting, you know. Peter, tell us about your book, Black Wreath.
Okay, Joe. I mean, it's funny because you started off mentioning the poetry, and I suppose I mean that's what I've been doing, I suppose, most of my kind of writing life. The Rooms is I think it's the eighth book of poems that I've published with the Gallery Press. But I've become, I suppose, over the years, kind of getting more and more interested. Partly, I suppose, having a child, having a daughter, and being a lot in children's bookshops and the children's section of bookshops and buying books and reading books. And partly also because my wife, Enda Wiley, is also a writer for children. So the kind of writing for children was in the air. Books for children was in the air. So I'd had it in my head that I would love to write a book for kind of younger readers. But I had never done anything about it. And then I was also, because I'm very interested in the history of Dublin. I live in the city centre.
Just before you go into the plot of the book, tell us just a little bit about yourself, Peter. I know you're from Waterford, born 1960, Trinity educated. What was your degree?
I did a degree in Irish and English. Right. Back in the mists of time.
According to your profile, You work as a translator sometimes. Is it Irish to English or
I've done a lot of well. over the years I've done a lot of work. I used to do an awful lot of kind of commercial sort of translation stuff like that, mainly from English to Irish. Now I don't do that so much. I do kind of literary translation, or I teach a course in translation in Trinity, for instance. But I don't do so much of the commercial stuff anymore. I did it for years, all right. I used to run a thing called the Irish Writers' Centre for about kind of 10, 11 years, and I left that about 2003.
You helped to run that, did you, Peter?
I did. I was the first kind of director of it. I mean, it was set up in 1991, and I'd been living abroad. I'd been in Holland and Italy for several years after leaving college, and then That was back in the bad old days, back in the 80s, when we used to go and see what we call the careers and disappointments officer in Trinity. And we would, because it was very little work, so a lot of us went and lived abroad. And I came back then, and this thing was being set up, the Irish Writers' Centre. So I managed to get a job running that. And that, so that was very interesting, because it kind of got the heart of writing and literature for 10 years at a time when there was a lot kind of happening, you know?
Yeah. So you're interested in the history of Dublin, I suppose that's
where it all came from, in a sense. The book came out of that kind of almost like an obsession, because I'm living in the city centre, and so I'm interested in exploring the history of the Liberties and all that.
You're a Liberties man, aren't you? Now
I live in a place actually called the Tenters, which is just down from the Liberties, right. And it's so cold because the old bales of cloth used to be hung on tenter hooks there now, where there's houses. But so sort of, and the thing, I suppose the thing that was the trigger for me was a French man actually called John Rock, who, he made a map of Dublin in 1756, and it's an amazing map, because it was the first kind of really detailed map of the city at a time when it was a very big place. And then he used to boast that every single building in the city was in his map. So I had this kind of on my computer, and I had it on my wall. And I used to kind of trace these kind of imaginary journeys through the city. You know, I used to trace these kind of journeys, you know, all around the city, with my fingertip kind of thing, and sort of imagine what it was like then. And so that led me to kind of reading, and I was reading about it, and I started to get into the history of it, and realizing what a kind of like tumultuous kind of place it was in the 18th century. It was crowded, violent, often lots of power struggles, kind of sectarian trouble. In a way, it was kind of like a Celtic tiger, you know, economy. You know, all these new squares being built. The city that we recognise now, all those Georgian squares were just being developed and built by big kind of developers.
Yeah, Dublin's famous for its Georgian squares and Georgian houses, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Mm. And you know, so suddenly you're at a point when it's being transformed from a kind of medieval city into this kind of Georgian city, and all that stuff is happening. And then I was reading this stuff, and I came across the story that became Black Reason. It was a story of a man, James Annesley, this boy who was abandoned by his father, effectively his father, who was a kind of aristocrat who needed money, and in order to get the money, he had to conceal the existence of his son, because he was kind of selling leases, if you like, on land that he had yet to inherit. So it would have been awkward.
That was an education for me. Yeah. That, you know, when you had an heir.
Yeah,
they had a claim on your on the.
You see, they would. So that was the kind of complication that he was finding. He was going around because he was basically a drunkard and a gambler. So he kind of was spending money like, kind of water. And then,
that's the father.
This is the father. And so then, in order, he knew he was going to inherit money from a relative, and so he was selling that land even before he'd inherited it. But under law, that land would have been would have gone to his heir, which was his first son, and he would have had prior claim over the people who had bought the land. So that was embarrassing. So he had to conceal the money from the people he was selling the land to, or he had to conceal his son.
We would have been operating under British law.
Yeah, absolutely,
we at that time?
Absolutely. So that was the legal kind of situation. So the basic kind of plot thing for me was, he suddenly had to get rid of his son, and there was a nasty kind of stepmother, as there always is in these stories as well, and she was very keen on getting rid of the son as well, you know?
As we say off the north, she was a piece of work,
she
all
was
right.
Certainly a piece of work, yeah. And so I came fascinated by her. And so
Miss Deacon, isn't it?
Miss Deacon. And yeah. So between the two of them, they kind of decide, okay, we'll get rid of the son. And basically, they give him away, you know, and then... and they give him away to... He's kind of sold to a kind of dancing master, again, in the city centre. And... he then escapes from there, and he basically becomes, kind of like a ragamuffin.
That's in the city. Yeah,
know?
Yeah, it's just ragamuffin.
And then, because to make things worse, I mean, he makes friends with this shoeboy Harry, who's working what's now kind of Temple Bar near what would have been the old port. And
is that where the old port was?
Yeah, Essex Quay there. That's where the ships came in, and so there was no kind of harbour docks kind of there, and the ships all came in there. And so Harry worked his shoe cleaning kind of operation out of there, and they decide one night he says to him, "Listen, your father can't be that bad. Maybe he's changed his mind. Maybe it'd be okay if you just go back to the house and make yourself known to him." So he goes back to the house, and he gets this terrible shock because he goes to the house and he sees there's a black wreath on the front door.
On the door, yes.
And he thinks, "Why is there a wreath on the door?" And he kind of sneaks into the back of the house where the servants are. And he knocks on the door and they let him in, and they let him, he says, "What's the wreath for?" And he says, "Well, it's for yourself. It's because you're dead. And they've had your funeral in Christchurch and everything, and there was great weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth, and your father was very sad and your stepmother was crying and all that." So they had put it out that the son had died tragically, whatever, and you know, and so conveniently he's been disposed of, except of course he's not dead, but you know, so he realizes he can't go back to his father, or you know, he's kind of stuck.
And is that loosely the sort of story of the young Ansley?
Well, it is. No, I mean, the stuff about the black wreath and all that is maybe poetic license.
But
the basic story is true. The basic story is true, and all the business about. I mean, eventually the father died, and the uncle took over,
The book certainly conveys a level of skullduggery of the time.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
And I must say to readers, I got the book and I read it myself. And when I was reading the brief on the back cover, and I was thinking, "Oh God, this is directed at 11-year-olds and plus." And I was thinking, "I have to read this for a review." And within a short space of time, I was really enjoying, and I mean, really enjoying it. Your language has been described by some as simplistic. Now, I'm not saying that all of your language is, but I found it very readable for that age group.
Yeah,
and I was putting myself in the frame of mind of a young boy, maybe 12, and think it actually brought me back to. I had to put myself in the frame of mind initially. As a 12, 13-year-old, to give myself, I says, let's give yourself a fair chance at appreciation of this. And when I said that to myself, it was like a key clicked or something, or a switch flicked.
Yeah.
And but thanks to your writing skills, I was easily, you know, transported to that period, and could imagine myself walking about in the dung, you know, around, you know, that the horses would have deposited on the cobbled streets.
Yeah.
And I really, you know, I was looking for more, you know, I was enjoying it so much. I surprised myself, you know. Well, and I think that's got more to do with the quality of the weaving of the story than any frame of mind that I predispositioned myself for, you know?
Yeah, I know what you mean. In terms of the writing, I mean, like what happened was when I read the story, the real story, and I just kind of sat down and I just, without thinking about it too much, I just wrote the first couple of chapters because the story kind of struck me so much. And I thought, and I wasn't even thinking at that time, you know, who exactly it's for, what age group it's for. I mean, I thought, okay, it's for younger readers. But I mean, it's, you know, teens have read it. I've seen it in the young adult section of bookshops, and I've also talked to kind of groups of school children in fifth and sixth class, and they're reading it. So it's quite a span. But in terms of how, I mean, I suppose what I was trying to do was just not get in the way of the story too much in terms of how I was writing it. That I wanted to let the kind of events speak for themselves. And I was trying to, you know, just give a sense of what it was like to be alive and in that situation then.
I think you've just helped explain, you know.
Yeah.
The part of the attractiveness and what gripped me, you know, it wasn't getting too flat. The language didn't become too flowery.
No, I didn't
for
know.
All of
I yeah, you don't want. Well, yeah, I don't know. You don't want to keep reminding people that they're reading a book, and
some authors do. You know, that's their style. You know, they're a bit over descriptive.
But so I mean, it was the story. And I mean, I had a lot of help actually with that as well, because I had a lot of help from in a sense that from my editor at O'Brien Press and all that. And for instance, one of the things that they did that was really helpful to me was when I sent in the book, they sent it out to a group of children as kind of readers to see what kind of reaction they'd have. And I got really great feedback, and you know, very specifically, like things like, for instance, I had a lot of description in the beginning, and they say, "Oh, you know, we don't want to feel that we're reading a history book." And so I thought, "Look, that's a good tip. Get straight into the action." Then they thought, "This guy Harry, we like him. Maybe he could do more. You know, maybe he could have more to do in the action." I said, "Okay, great. I'll involve him more." And I brought him, and you know, he wasn't originally. He goes to America to help rescue the boy at one point. So that was coming from the feedback from the kids who'd read it. And all that kind of thing. So I had lots. I was lucky to get that kind of assistance. But it was great to actually get feedback from children, and you know, who would be the people who would be the audience to say, you really need to think about this, and that. And I did think about them, and I put in extra chapters, and I put in, and I changed things around, and I, you know, just so there was a whole process, which that was one of the advantages of working with O'Brien Press.
Actually, the description of your language as sometimes simplistic, as in simplistic the read, actually come from Carl Rumens, who made your poem Legacies Guardian Poem of the Week back in July 2012, you know. And so that's, I wasn't sort of taking it upon myself to, describe your work as that, you know. But anyway... So James is, he's been farmed out to his, we're at the point where he's been farmed out to the dancing master,
yeah,
he makes an escape from there,
yeah.
And having found out that he's family are
yeah,
going through the bereavement process for his supposed death, he then encounters Jack Darcy,
yeah, or even like he does it. He does eventually. He spends a time living in Trinity College because he gets involved in a kind of big gang fight between. He gets caught up in this big gang fight between the Liberty Boys, the kind of Protestant gang, and the big Protestant gang in the city at the time, and the Ormond Boys, the Catholic butchers. That was part of the sort of scene at the time, if you like. And he got kind of caught in the battle, and he met this Trinity student, and they were being given a hard time by the butchers, and then one kind, if you like, butcher let them go, and so he ended up working for this man in Trinity. And then eventually, yeah, you're right. He things go from bad to worse. The Trinity student gets involved in a murder. He has to escape from Trinity, and he ends up in Phoenix Park. He thinks, okay, because where in Dublin can he go? Where can he hide? Where can he live? And so he gravitates, as a lot of people did at the time, towards the Phoenix Park, this huge, big, open forest, effectively. So a lot of gangs used to hide out there, and so he ended up there. And of course, as soon as he goes there, he meets the Darcy gang, Jack Darcy and his gang of highwaymen and footpads and robbers. And because again, we remember that people talk about Dublin being dangerous now. I mean, you hear, you know, people on radio shows giving out about O'Connor Street, whatever. Yeah. But if you lived in Dublin in the 18th century, you could hardly...
I got that sense from your books it was a really dodgy place to be.
It was a dark and dangerous place, full of gangs, and again, like you had these gangs, one of the most notorious was a crowd called the Pink and Dindies.
Right.
And they were kind of like, often Trinity students, and they used to cut the bottom off their scabbard so the sword was exposed, the blade was exposed, and they could just go around sticking it into people's legs and stuff just for the crack,
goodness.
You know? You know, you'd read reports, people walking along the quays being thrown into the river and robbed, and people were, you know, if they went to the theatre, like, you talk about Smock Alley. Smock Alley was a great target, so you had all these plays, and then, you know, people would be walking home along Temple Bar and would be set upon in the dark alleys by thieves, and they used to think, like, they would, you know, they would get the women used to keep their money in a kind of pocket inside their dress, and so they would go what they call pocketing, and they'd cut the pockets from the women's dresses and that kind of thing. So I mean, it was a vicious kind of, and you see things, you didn't have lights, you didn't have street lighting like you do now, you didn't have police. You had kind of ineffective kind of police,
you certainly had strong enough sanctions. My goodness, you would have
been hung at the drop of a hat. You were, and I mean, I was showing, because I mean, one of the things that inspired me was a set of pictures by a man called James Hamilton, who painted from the life, or like drew from the life of the time, and there's an image of three criminals in a cart on their way to Stephen's Green to be hanged, and they're there kind of saying their prayers. you could be hanged for anything. Yeah, I mean robbery, burglary in particular, because if you went into somebody's house, that was a huge crime.
And they didn't discriminate with regard to sex. I mean,
they hung women, children. I mean, age didn't matter. They didn't have any kind of sense of. I mean, yeah, and again, if ever anybody goes into Kilmainham jail, you get all that history of. The history of the execution of children, all that kind of stuff in the jail there. So, I mean, you know, that was part of the kind of the time. I mean, and you had these notorious kind of judges who just sentenced people to death at the drop of a hat. And it was a little bit of the sense that life was kind of nasty, brutish and short, you know, that. And so that's where he finds himself. So he finds himself suddenly in this dangerous kind of gang. And of course, he has to be one of the gang, which means he has to start getting involved in crime, you know?
That's right. For his class, the environment he was brought up in, socially, it was a galactic journey.
Yeah.
Although we find himself in it mentally and socially,
it
would be a galactic journey for a person to make that
completely.
Leap, you know, from lord to.
Yeah.
To. And those damnable beggar. Yeah,
and those are the extremes, because some of those are places of extremes. And you had these great extremes, because you had these great houses.
The extremities.
And you had lots of wealth, you know, and you had a whole underclass of servants, and then you had people who were kind of completely impoverished. So yeah, for him, I mean, to have had a life of, you know, just there's food on the table, there's servants dressing you, there's, you know, you've got all of these kind of things you take for granted, and suddenly you're out on the street, and the street is a cruel place, and you know, and then suddenly you're involved in a gang of criminals. So yeah, so he's it's a huge journey for him. Yeah.
Well, we'll not delve much further into it, because I think we'd be revealing too. You know, we don't want to reveal too much about it. But I can tell you that I did read it all through very quickly, and I did feel at the end, I thought, God, I want more of this book. And will we be getting any more, Peter, from James Lovett?
Well, I might go back to him. I've actually written another book which is set in the same period, but it's more about the Hellfire Club and the people behind that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sort of devil worshipping and gambling and that kind of stuff. So I've done one again, similar kind of period, and about a different story. But I might well go back and revisit the other one.
I would certainly get a copy of it. Yeah. I'd go out and buy a copy of it, because I really did enjoy it. And you know, I'd love to hear what young Lord Lovett, if he ever became that, what he would do, you know. And but Peter, tell us about your book, The Rooms.
The Rooms, which is it's the latest book from the Gallery Press, and it's actually going to be launched in Hodges Figures next Thursday, the 27th. But it's a collection of poems I've been working on. I mean, poems take me, I suppose, a long enough time to produce, and so a book comes out every kind of 5 years or so.
Is it all your work in here, or have you selected any others?
It's all my own work. Although there is the last section is like a conversation with Bertolt Brecht, so it's kind of like I translated quite a lot of his poems as part of that. So it's kind of translations and me and imaginary people kind of talking to Brecht as well. I suppose a lot of the poems, again, they have to do with just, you know, my own life and the city, because the city kind of comes up a lot in what I write.
You have produced a number of books of poetry, haven't you?
That's right. This is probably too many. This is the eighth. So there's a lot.
I'm just looking at my list of awards here. The Patrick Kavanagh Poetry Award 82, Poetry Ireland Review Award 2000 to 2007. I mean, you're up there with the winners according to your accolades, Peter. Would you like to make a comment on that statement?
Yeah, what can you say about that? No, it's just, I mean, those things are a bit of a lottery in a sense. I mean, you know, sometimes, and it doesn't really matter in the end. I mean, it's nice if you get if you get some kind of recognition, because right. it's because poets generally
that's
are,
really what
are,
I'm asking
are,
how, poets how generally do you feel are, about the awards?
You see, poets generally are pretty invisible. Poetry is a pretty invisible art in a way that I mean you don't have the huge kind of brouhaha about it that you might have about prose. I mean, you do have a small enough maybe audience, but there is an audience for it. But the awards, or any kind of award for any kind of writer, is just a kind of, it's a bit of a pat on the back, or it kind of says to you, okay, it's okay what you're doing, you know, maybe it's not too bad, and so it's a bit of an encouragement to get on with it. But then again, lots of writers throughout history have never got any kind of accolades or rewards, or weren't even published in their lifetime. I mean, you know, you think of Hopkins or Emily Dickinson, so I mean, yes. It's a bit dangerous to be too hung up on the whole thing of who gets what award and, you know, that kind of thing. It can be a bit of a racket, and it's more to do with PR sometimes than it is to do with the work, you know.
I was wondering, would you read one poem for us, Peter? It's a Mapmaker song, and the reason I'm asking you to read this, it's the first one in your book, The Rooms by Peter Serra, and... I mean, I'm asking because you were talking about your love of cartography,
yeah.
and how you found it, you know, an inspiration.
Yeah,
the cartography of Douglas,
John Rock, Rock.
That's
the mapmaker. Yeah,
the mapmaker. How it's helped inspire you for your book, Black Wreath. And it's a sort of, as you happen to mention yourself, as a tie-in for both books. If
sure.
Would you read it for us, please?
Sure, I'd be delighted to. Yeah,
thank you.
The Mapmaker Song. The mapmaker downed his tools. I've caught it. Every alley, every street, every fanlight and window ledge. The city fixed and framed. Now I want everything else. I want to be a historian of footsteps, a cartographer of hemlines and eyelids. I want to catch what the pavements say when they sing to each other in their deep laboratories, plotting every journey since the place began. I want the whole unlosable database, the repeating place, kings stalking the server farms, tailbacks and looped alarms. I want to be where brushstrokes flicker on a bank of screens, where graveyards tilt and quiet populations crowd the air, their quarters risen again, their furniture smashing through the floors. I want to stand at the centre of a great clutter, mapping ashes, mapping bones, archivist, enumerator, hanger on, signing the returns of an infinite census. I want to be beyond everything I've reached or drawn, not much at all, or all there is, a geographer of breath, a curator of hands. I want to lie in the atrium of the museum of the fingertip and touch, touch, touch.
Thank you very much, Peter. Thank you very much. So there we are, The Rooms by Peter Serra, for anyone interested in poetry, or even for anyone that isn't particularly interested in poetry, but that, I don't know, would like maybe to get a book for Christmas for someone that does, or for young students of English even, you know, who are studying the Leaving Cert. I couldn't see reading this book doing anyone any harm. It could only have... a positive effect. And Black Wreath, I'd certainly recommend that for a Christmas stocking for anyone. Very enjoyable. Very enjoyable. Peter, thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks very much, Joe.
And I'd just like to thank again Michael Sharp for his review of To Wake at a Decent Hour. And to thank all those at Smock Alley for the contributions that they did make but didn't hear. This is Joe Collins. Cover to Cover, Near FM. Thank you very much.